You are listening to Microchurches, a podcast for missionaries and leaders living out their God-given calling through this small expression of the church. This podcast is meant to encourage, equip, and contribute to the overall discussion of this smaller way. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy. You are listening to Microchurches, a podcast for people brave enough to be small. This is your host, Tommy Wilkerson, and in this season, we are talking to network leaders, microchurch leaders, and subject matter experts on things pertaining to microchurch mission and what it means to try to follow Jesus in this smaller way. And so in this particular episode, I'm super excited to be joined by Brian Sanders talking about collaboration. And so Brian, as always, thank you so much for being generous with your time and hanging out with me.
Because we believe in honesty and vulnerability, I think the listeners should know that was your third take on the opening.
It was so bad. I would get so close and I'd be like, nope, I missed a word. I forgot. Fun fact, I actually get nervous before every podcast interview. Like, you just never know how it's going to go. And I don't know, Brian, you give me the butterflies. I got it all messed up this time. But
So I get three mistakes as well.
Oh, that you're totally fine. Yeah, okay. Make as many mistakes as you want.
Don't edit them out.
just leave them in there. Well, kind of to today's topic and today's subject, I want to talk about collaboration. I want to talk about that as it pertains to microchurches and what that means for them. Because, among the other things that you're known for. So, of course, you founded The Underground, were its executive director for a number of years, and just recently kind of transitioned out of that role. But a lot of what you've been doing since then has been a lot of stuff around building alliances and coalitions and stuff like that. And so I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that work that you've been doing. And in general, just like as you have kind of watch these things grow, just as you talked about, the shift from a creator economy to a collaborator economy. I just love you to, just talk a little bit about the work that you've done and things that you've seen.
I was thinking the other day about what has kind of led me to this emphasis in my own career or even theology, I guess. It's like, I don't know if we've talked about this, but in a dictionary, you have a definition of a word, but then there's multiple definitions, and then they number them, right? Presumably usage, like this one's more often the definition of this word, but there may be multiple definitions, and so they have to put that in there, like number one, number two, number three. And it just occurred to me that if you went to look up the word church in the kind of usage, modern contemporary usage of the word church, I'd say 20 years ago, the number one would have been like a place we gather to worship or something, a place Christians gather to worship, something like that. Right.
Yeah.
And then, in many ways, maybe number two would have been like the people of God gathered wherever they are, or something like that. And in many ways, the first real push, maybe it was the second real push of my own career and thinking and stuff, was to try to get number two to be number one.
Right.
To push number one down in its usage. It's still okay to think of the church as some building on the corner, but should that be the number one way in which we conceive church? No. So this is probably a lot of what the microchurch conversation is about. It's about pushing a more grassroots human communal definition of the church up and pushing that one that says it's that place where we worship that has a pastor and a building and a marquee and whatever, pushing that down. But actually there's another meaning to the word church, which is something transcendent, something that expands across time and space, something that's seen in the timeless eternal mind of God. In that sense, it's church with like a capital C, the church belonging to every people group and every place and every time. And maybe that's like number three, actually. Like it's the last thing we think about, And it just occurred to me that I'm feeling this kind of compulsion to try to push that up in the usage and the definition, that this is maybe the next phase of my own career and life and thinking and work, is to try to, I don't know, maybe that's number one. I don't know which should be number one, but the building should be number three. Can we just agree that that should be the last connotation of the word church? But maybe there's something even more profound and important about feeling a part of this eternal community, this family defined by the mind of God, the heart of God that exists, you know, what, you know, Vincent de Lorenz would say, in all time, all places, among all people, all Christian people. It's just a powerful idea. And I guess I'm discovering that the work around that, so the practical work of saying, okay, unity, union, collaboration, alliance, you know, co-belligerence, whatever, however we sort of commit to each other to triangulate and tackle some other problem, or to be something together beyond our differences, past our differences, is really actually hard and maybe even impossible. But it's hard enough, or it's confusing enough, or it's ambiguous enough that we don't really do it. You know, just today I was thinking about unity, the idea of unity, as an innovation. You know, actually, we've never really tried it. You know, as much as we appreciate John 17, we've never actually really committed ourselves functionally, tactically, to, you know, the church in that sort of third connotation. The church has something beyond our buildings and beyond our communities and beyond our doctrinal enclaves. Have we even tried it? And do we even really know? Certainly not in the West, and certainly not in my lifetime. So I don't think we really fully understand the potential in it. Aside from what Jesus is saying, which is like, this is how the whole world will know that I was sent by the Father, is if you do this, you know, if you have oneness with each other. But also I think there's a whole set of skills that come along with figuring out how to do it, which are just foreign to us. So I like that too. I mean, that's just maybe my personality, but I like the kind of experimental side of social science and what we'd have to call social technology. I mean, the microchurch is social technology. It's a way of doing something together. It's a way that people can organize and reshape something and actually leave an impression on the world, you know. But so is collaboration. It's a social technology that we have to figure out, you know, and all of that's very interesting and fascinating. And then, not to be, you know, overly self-important, but, you know, it feels like an important thing to be involved in right now. It feels like maybe because of the bifurcation of our own country. I just saw, what's her name? Twenge. Her most recent book, what's her first name?
Jean,
thank you. Her most recent book is called Generations, and she covers every generation. And then the most recent generation she's calling polars, which I'd never heard that term before. So Gen Z then gives way to what she calls polars. And polars, the reason why she's coining that term, I think, is because of the polarization of this era, this last 10 years or so. Everything is split in two. Everything is camps. Everything is bifurcated. So, you know, it feels like especially important, maybe, as a prophetic gesture. Maybe it always was, but in a time of division, of rancor, you know, of disunity, unity becomes not only an innovation, but it becomes a prophetic witness.
Yeah.
To the power of the people of God, the difference, it's a differentiator if we can figure it out. So again, it feels to me like the frontier of something. It feels like an innovation. It feels like a discovery, much in the way that, you know, our work around empowerment and smaller church was, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. Which, I mean, there's so many things in that I think are worth unpacking. I mean, even, which I think you talk about in your book, which we'll talk about later, that'll be kind of the call to action, the five keys to cross organizational
collaboration.
Yeah. You talk about the way that, you know, especially you, I think the paragraph, the sentence that you mentioned is like, I was being a head of a nonprofit for 20 years to talk about collaboration. There's like a squint that you get, like you're not quite sure, you're skeptical of the whole endeavor. And what I find interesting, even talking about the church and the church in unity, is we do carry that sense of skepticism. Like, I even think about somebody like Francis Chan. Francis Chan writes a book on unity, and he's like, we should be united. Like, this is what Jesus talks about in Ephesians 4. Like, we should be united. And people are like, nope, hard pass. We don't want to be in unity.
That can't be right.
And it's like, what? Like, how does that work, right? Like, even in the same family, part of the same body, it's a body that wants to disassociate from other body parts. Like, man, do we really need the pinky finger? Like, we can move on without it. And so to even talk about collaboration and unity in the church and the church being so skeptical towards it, and then, yeah, maybe that being not even symptomatic, but I mean, the church is that way, but society even more so, these polarizing camps. And then to talk about, hey, can we come together for the common good, for a common good, is really interesting. I don't know if I even piece those two things together, like the decline of trust, the need for collaboration, and how those two things.
But the bottom line is that the forces pulling us apart are greater than the forces drawing us together.
Yeah.
So if we can find a way to marshal the will, the dunamis, the power of God, the miraculous power of God, to work together, to see each other as partners, somehow compatriots, whatever, that'd be pretty amazing. I mean, it would wake people up, I think, or it would demand attention, wouldn't it? Because even when you mention unity or collaboration or working with those people over there, I mean, immediately we shut down. That's maybe the point you're making. Because of experience, you know, like having flirted with partnership and collaboration. And see, I mean, how many people do I know have gone into business with somebody and it ended badly? You know, their partner betrayed them or stole something or whatever. And churches are a story. I mean, the story of the local church is a story of schism. It's a story of fracturing, right? Of breaking into pieces.
Yeah.
Something starts and then over time it gets broken up into pieces. Now, we could talk about that if you want, but I have my own thinking on that, which is actually, is that a part of the resiliency and the strength of the church? That actually, it's meant to be broken into pieces, and actually, it never, you know, the reason why it's a super organism is because that's precisely what it does. It keeps breaking down into smaller contextual pieces and then reforming itself in every place that it is, and to every kind of important sensibility, to every value system that's, you know, godly or holy or whatever. But yeah, I mean, to say that the world is polarized and stuff is almost it's almost boring now. It's so, but I think to say, or even to be a sort of doomsday predictor of negativity is, it's just become tired.
Yeah.
You know, it's unoriginal. It lacks faith, you know, cynical people, I find them boring now. People saying what's all going to go wrong and so on. I'm really fascinated. I don't agree with people like Steven Pinker, but I think they're called like the new positivists or something. That's this this group of people that are basically saying, you know, the world's, there, a lot of good things are happening. Yeah. There's a lot of reason to be optimistic about the future. I don't know that I totally agree, but I like that. I like that school of thought because it feels prophetic. It feels like a challenge to the cynic in all of us. And the person that maybe almost immediately dismisses the possibility of collaboration or partnership with people that are different because it's like, well, you know, that won't work. I know it won't work. And that just sounds weighty. You know, it sounds wise. But maybe a little bit of naivete is what we need. You know, right. That's the shape that faith needs to take in our time.
I mean, it occurs to me, even as we talk about collaboration, that, I mean, there is a, and maybe it's in your book too, just like the idea of collaboration, and maybe one of the things that keeps us from collaboration, I wonder, which we're going to wrestle with that question more, is weakness and vulnerability, right? To like, to come into a collaborative relationship with somebody. I guess you could come at it from a place of strength. You could try at least, but part of what you're admitting in collaboration is that I actually don't have everything within me to conquer this problem. I do actually need somebody and need you to come against this thing with me. And how that fights against maybe our American self-reliance, like you make things happen for yourself in some way. And I don't know, I think that's an interesting thing, right? Like our own cultural forces that keep us apart and individualized from each other. I didn't even think about like, Doris Kearns Goodwin and her book on FDR. And amongst all the, there's lots of things that we could pick apart from FDR's time. But I think one of the things that was really fascinating reading her telling of that era of history, that particular time in history.
For the uninitiated, that's Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah. Keep going. There you go. Is that he, just so there's this big thing that's happening in the world. And there was a sense of, okay, yeah, we're actually not big enough to conquer it. And so we actually need everybody, all hands on deck, to help us navigate the world wars. Like we have to, and you know, so we're redoing these tire distribution factories and we're making them something else. And if you are gonna get sugar, your sugar has to look different because we're all in this collaborative effort together. We're coming up against something that's bigger than ourselves. And so there's a way in which collaboration pulls at our our American independence, self-reliance, but it's not like it's completely foreign. Like we do have a sense and have had instances where, oh, actually, as hard as this time in our history is, we actually came together in a really beautiful way and we became something that we weren't before. And so, I don't know, just listening to you talk makes me think about that as well.
Yeah, and I make the argument in the book that one of the keys to collaboration is this, the term I'm using is exhaustion, you know, to come to the end of yourself, to come to the, to feel exhausted is to have, well, it's to have emptied yourself. It's to have exhausted all of your resources. And to, you know, at the end of a day, let's say that you've worked outside or something, manual labor or something, you can feel just depleted, like utterly emptied of power.
Yeah.
My guess is that that feeling of exhaustion spiritually in terms of ministry is known to people. Maybe even people listening, they've felt that, they've been there, that point of exhaustion. Maybe you're listening right now, that's where you are. But there comes a fork in the road, in my view, at that point of exhaustion. And you can either move towards kind of capitulation. You can give up. And that's very tempting. You know, but the other possibility is collaboration, is to say, well, it is, it's also kind of like giving up, you know, it's giving up the idea that we could do this. Like our organization, our church, our group is the answer to this problem or the world's problems or to save our whole city. You know, I make the argument that every sort of church planter thinks secretly thinks they're going to be the one that kind of wins the city. That I don't mean to belittle by laughing, but that hubris, you know, in the young church planter, in many ways is good. You know, you want that. You want that belief, that sense of audacity, you know, that you're going to be the one. But you're not. You're not going to be the one. And there's nothing theologically that would signal that one church will be the answer. One organizational church would be the answer for an entire city or a massive cause or problem or something like that. But when you come to the end of yourself, when you realize I've tried everything and it just hasn't worked, and it almost like feeling futility, like, did this matter at all? You know, did this make a difference at all? That's an amazing moment, really, for Jesus and for the kingdom of God and for the potential work of collaboration. Because in my experience working, trying to build collaborations and convene collaborations, those are the people you want. Mm-hmm. You want the people that have not quit. So they've not chosen to go down that road of cynicism and just giving up and post-Christian and all that. But I've kind of feel like, but emotionally and spiritually, and just I'm out of ideas, you know, just like, I'm not sure what to do now. But maybe I could work with you. Maybe we could work together. Maybe we're capable of something together that I wasn't capable of on my own. Mm. And suddenly that just makes so much sense. Like, what was I thinking before?
Yeah.
That we would be the one, and just how maybe misguided and even, I don't know, heretical that idea was to begin with, you know? But this is what you want. You want people at a place of exhaustion, not that there is no energy left to move forward, but that they've tried everything. They've come to the end of themselves. They've come to their own limits and realize, okay, maybe if we all work together, you know, something can happen. This is, I think, the point you're trying to bring up, you know, limitation, realizing limitation, and in the weakness of that, there is strength. Something, the power of God is made manifest in the discovery of weakness, in the surrender of your own inability to do actually anything kingdom-wise, you know. This is, what is it, kenosis, you know, it's like emptying yourself. Right. This is what Jesus does to save the world. He doesn't consider equality with God something to be grasped, but he empties himself, taking on the form of a slave, a servant, and makes himself obedient to death, you know, even death on a cross. Okay, so is that just something Jesus does? No, that Christology is meant to be applied probably to our own discipleship. How are we coming to an emptying of ourselves? And so I think people that have been going at ministry for a while and had all these hopes and dreams and maybe have hit a wall or think this isn't working, man, you are in such a beautiful, important place in your life. If you seize upon it, if you recognize, if you have some kind of fellowship with Jesus in that, to realize this is what he did too. He poured himself out. He emptied himself and he was left with nothing. And it's at that point, you know, that he makes himself obedient ultimately unto death. And the world is saved, you know, incredible. Yeah. So I'm not saying our emptiness can save the world, but our emptiness can lead us to see the body of Christ the way you have outlined it already, you know, and to recognize maybe a tactical choice that we just haven't tried.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, I don't know, as you're talking about collaboration, leaders coming to the end of themselves, I mean, as we have journeyed with microchurch leaders, you know, we talk about how as you lead and persist in mission, your needs as a leader, they shift. So before, maybe what you're looking for from someone is permission and you're looking for tools and resources and you're just trying to get something off the ground. But as you go through it and you hit walls and you come to the end of yourself, the question shifts and it becomes more about like, how do I keep doing this? Like this is hard. And you're trying to figure out how can I do this for the rest of my life when it feels like I actually can't do this for another week. This is just hard. And we talk about the need for other leaders in your life and relationships and reciprocity and, you know, just someone who gets it, missionary peers. But even in that, I, you know, It seems like, yeah, there's a way that that's a gift and a service to a leader. But as I'm listening to you talk about collaboration, it's like, well, what if collaboration is also a gift that, like, is you don't necessarily have to partner with each other on something. You don't have to somehow merge and form some coalition. But if you did, it very well could keep you going. It could keep you in the game that much longer.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to disagree with that statement, but I don't know if that's going to be the driver to that choice. Because I think if you're thinking, how do I keep going because I am personally depleted and I just don't know if I can go on, I'm not sure collaboration is the way to go, because I just think it'll be hard in a different way. And you'll also find yourself just being very incompetent. But if you want to solve a problem, if your greater dream or desire is like, so some of the causes I work with, you know, every orphan, you know, every child in the system of care to have a safe, loving home, whether that's permanency or foster home or an adoptive home or whatever, or reunification, every child deserves that. And we have to keep trying until we make sure that there is not a single child that doesn't get that. And if you want that more than anything, then collaboration is the next step. It's the only step, actually, to realize, yeah, for a while you worked in your own little lane, your own silo, trying to solve that problem from one angle. But then you come to that place of exhaustion. But it's that greater goal. So if we still care about disciples, if we still care about like the gospel, if we still care about, you know, the glory of God covering the earth as the waters cover the sea, if that still wakes you up at night, if that's still what drives your heart, then yes, collaboration is the way forward when you come to that place of futility and exhaustion. But if you're just trying to like sort of solve your own inner emotional problems or whatever, it wouldn't be my suggestion. Probably quitting may be actually the way to go if that's what you want. Because, and I really don't mean to be snide, but that's a self-concern. That's a selfish pathway. It's about you and what's best for you. And probably ministry was always going to be mostly just suffering and laying down your life, you know, but for something incredibly worth it. And one day in eternity, you'll recognize it was worth it in a way that words can't describe, you know, but costly, you know, ministry is costly, and collaboration is just another form of ministry, possibly a higher form of ministry. But this whole sort of, you know, inner struggle between, should I just look after myself? Should I do what's right for me, for my family? Mm-hmm. I think some people are coming to that point of exhaustion and just choosing that. And in many ways it delivers, you know, it does kind of, you suddenly feel free of a burden. Now let's check back with those people in 15 years. And let's see if a new burden has replaced it, you know.
Yeah.
I'd say it will. But, and again, I don't mean to be critical of people's choices. It's not my place to judge them. But if you care about the kingdom more than you care about yourself, which for me has always been a kind of litmus test of true discipleship, you know, it's like you know, anyone who puts his hand to a plow to follow me and turns back is not worthy of me, Jesus said. So like you know, this is a life commitment that I've made, that we've made, and there is no turning back, you know. But if I want to do what's best for me personally, an easier road, there's lots easier things. And it's funny because we see, I'm working with loads of people, loads of Christian people who are trying to now, and I'm not the first person. I mean, lots of people have been doing this for years, trying to find ways to collaborate and bring people together and work together. And it's hard and disheartening in different ways. You know, it's like also, we're just, making wrong decisions all the time. We're using a sort of previous framework for leadership and interaction with each other. You know, I make the argument that we're very good at strategy within a hierarchy. You know, we know how to sort of climb a mountain to set a goal and say, let's work as an organization. Let's bring some people in that work for you, and you can sort of mandate what they do, and you can strategically work together. That is a kind of collaboration, but it's a collaboration within a hierarchy.
Right.
And that's not what I mean. And I don't think that's what Jesus meant. And I think when we're talking about churches or organizations or agencies that are equals, that all have different boards of directors, that have different tax exempt purposes, that have different constituents that they're trying to satisfy somehow, whether that's conscious or unconscious, when they come into a room, come together, and then nobody has a lever. Nobody has a lever to force anyone to do anything. Mm. How do they work together? Well, what are the rules for that? It's brand new. So if you like being on the front end of something, it's kind of cool. It's kind of exciting because we're figuring out as we go. Even me, I'm, you know, someone the other day styled me as I was on a call, like an international call with a foundation in Paris, and the person introducing me stopped me as an expert in collaboration. And I just bristled at that because, not because I have some false humility or something, because I just don't think there's such a thing. I mean, to me, it feels like such a nascent thing that anybody that claims to be an expert on it is tricking you. You know, we're just figuring out as we go. And if there is any kind of skill to it, the skill is kind of tactical openness. It's just to say, we're not sure yet, you know, we'll see, but it is hard in its own way.
No. Yeah. That's great. Which, I mean, I think, you know, maybe it's not that, I guess what I was wondering, it's like, it might not be like you're exhausted, you've come to the end of yourself, you're wondering if you can make it, and collaboration saves you. But I wonder if, like, maybe one of the gifts, an unexpected gift in collaboration that maybe you didn't know going in, but like, yeah, say you're doing something in foster care or something like that, and all of a sudden you come alongside these other people. It's like you went in because of this problem, but maybe the unexpected gift is like, oh wait, but I actually found comrades too.
Totally. No, that's
and
a great
that's
point.
And you guys, I don't want to say saved me, but you kept me going in a way that I didn't know that I needed.
That is a great point. Yeah. And I have a couple of live examples of kind of you know, agency heads that have come together that just didn't really know each other, they knew each other by name or reputation, but now they're working on a complex plan together with us and getting to know each other and cheering for each other. And the bond that you can see formed between them is extraordinary. And the like emerging love that they have for each other. Because the truth is, nobody can really understand what it's like to be an agency head in that, in their cause, in their field, except for them. And the fact that they were kind of estranged from each other is diabolical. You know, it's like, you know, the devil's trick. You know, no house, any house divided against itself can't stand, Jesus said. That's what the devil does, right? The devil pulls us apart so that we're weakened by it, you know? And yeah, we run around weak in our silos. And I do think you're right. I think that's a great counterpoint to what I was saying, that maybe, you know, a deeper sense of like being known by people, especially leaders, you know, leaders who feel lonely. You know, leadership is by definition kind of a lonely thing because you're just thinking about the project or the enterprise in a way that's slightly different than everybody else. And to find that kind of camaraderie with other leaders can be very rewarding, strengthening.
Which, I mean, I think, and as you talk about in your book, it's like, and what made me think about this is you talk about leadership and how leadership gets complicated in more collaborative settings, like not just hierarchical, but like peer to peer. We're sitting at eye level next to each other, equal participants and owners over this project or this collaboration that we've formed, and how that gets really hard when you have maybe big charismatic leaders that kind of take up space. Whereas, you know, microchurch leaders are often you're kind of ordinary people. And so there is a way in which, you know, perhaps microchurches can lend themselves to collaboration, maybe a little bit easier because not a whole lot of experts in the room. Everyone's kind of trying to figure out what works. And maybe they're experts in a really niche way, but they are niche, right? So not everything, but a particular lane. But yeah, as we were talking about it, I think that question of like, what keeps us from collaborating? What makes it hard for us? And like, what would need to shift in our thinking or in our work in order for us to actually be able to meaningfully collaborate with each other was maybe the question that we wanted to wrestle with a little bit.
You know, the ills of macro churches can also befall the micro church, you know? So don't kid yourself. You still can have egomaniacs leading micro churches. You know, you still can have megalomaniacs leading micro churches. God, I saw that shiny Happy People documentary about the Duggars and kind of the Bill Gothard stream and all that stuff, and just kind of essentially building into men. I'm sure there were redeeming qualities to that curriculum, but building into men essentially to be the head of their own family in a way that was just tapping into their worst qualities as men, you know? Mm. So I'm not against headship or family leadership, but just this dominance, and it's just gross. It has not aged well. You know, that view of family leadership, it just clearly has loads of problems in it. But so it just occurs to me that you can have a small, I mean, the whole idea is like, oh, have as many kids as you can, because that just makes you more people to dominate, more people to obey your every word, you know, to be a part of your little kingdom. And you still can have that very ugly side of leadership dominance, even in a very small context. But also the independent thing of like, we're supposed to do everything ourselves. We're not, we don't think about collaboration. It doesn't occur to us. So even microchurches, I would venture to say that the majority of microchurches that I've seen and work with have never even entertained the idea of collaborating in a regular functional way, unless they're a very focused niche, like they need mental health counseling, and so they collaborate with somebody that provides mental health counseling, or they need some, you know, work with homeless people, so they have a lot of homeless people coming in, so they work with somebody that can provide certain services or something like that. But typically, I think it doesn't even occur to us. I was thinking the other day about merging. I'm just starting to hear little rumors, rumblings of church mergers around the country. Every time I hear one, I stop and I ask them to break it down and tell me the story, like what happened. And I wonder if that's something that's kind of, you know, on the horizon. Are we going to see more church mergers? And I just think that's so fascinating. And in a way, why hasn't that happened more in the history of the Western church? Why is there so few mergers? So few denominational mergers. You know, again, people are coming to the end of themselves. They're realizing, oh, we're out of ideas. We don't know what to do next. We're losing people, you know, and they're not sure what to do next. And the obvious choice is to merge. You know, you take a church that, say, has land or a building and maybe a beautiful, healthy legacy of mission, and you take a church plant that's full of some people and some young families and ideas and dreams and maybe some inspiring young leaders. What a lovely partnership that could be, you know? And just why isn't that happening more? But I'm starting to hear about that. But in the microchurch world, man, how many mergers have we seen, Tommy? I mean, like, shouldn't we be seeing dozens of them?
Yeah. You know? Which was a question that I had, like, is that the reason why we don't see collaboration? Is because there's a sense that, like, what I'm doing is distinct, like,
yeah,
like I,
right,
like if I wanted to do what you are doing, I would do it with you. I can't speak English today.
That's it. Yeah.
And so it's like, I have to, I am distinct. I am my own thing. And yeah, maybe it doesn't occur to collaborate, or maybe it's just like that creator thing where it's like, I'm meant to start things. I don't necessarily join other people's things. And if we get too close to each other, will we judge each other because you do something different than I? We reach the same people, but we do it differently. Are we going to feel like we're somehow consuming or co-opting each other? And so it's like just easier to, yeah, you go reach that block over there and I'll reach this block over here, and we're happy coexisting with each other. So it was one thing to like move from seeing each other as competitors to say, okay, maybe we're not competitors. We're on the same team. We're all in the kingdom together. So I'm happy with coexistence.
Divide and conquer.
Yeah.
You take that over there. I'll take this over here. And we're in relationship.
Yeah.
No, totally. Yeah. It's really something for us to unpack. Maybe not in this forum, but you know, even just thinking about the underground, you know, what is wrong that's not a more prevalent option for people? I mean, I'm, you know, cards on the table. Yeah. I've had a house church for a million years, and I recently thought, well, I want to merge with somebody, you know? So I've tried, I've gone to now three different house churches and said, and basically said, will you merge, you know, in my own way, slowly bringing it up and stuff, and no takers.
You're just too intimidating, Brian.
Well, okay. But I even offered to not come.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm just curious about that dynamic. Like, I want to see what would happen in a merger, you know, because what's the downside? And so maybe part of the downside, and we can own this and repent of this, maybe part of the downside is we have one less microchurch. Now, this goes to our counting, our metrics, what we think is important. Yeah. Right. So if you have two house churches that become one house church, it's just one big church, that's one house church that comes off the board. And I wonder if that's part of it too. I wonder if it's like we're meant to multiply more and more and more micro churches. We don't want to go the other direction, you know, or move towards a bigger macro church or something like that. So that's probably like a limiting belief. You know, it's something that we're not quite seeing correctly. And I'm not proposing that we should just go around and merge everything. I'm just saying we should be free to think of that as a possibility. And surely there are microchurches that could sure use a merger. You know, like you have something I don't have and I have something you don't have. And if we could find a way to work together, if we could become something together, we could be healthier, stronger, more effective. I don't know. I don't have answers for it. I'm only bringing it up because it's fresh in my own mind. You know.
Yeah. So then, I mean, we talked about it a little bit, some of the things that keep us from collaborating with each other. But yeah, if there's anything else, or like what would need to shift in our thinking, is it just a matter of like, one, you have to, well, I guess obviously if you weren't thinking about it before, to see it as an option, that's like the first thing, is to be aware that it is an option on the table to collaborate, to join together for something. But yeah, I mean, what else would need to shift in our thinking and the way that we operate in order for us to see collaboration as this really interesting, innovative piece of social technology?
You know, I another point I make in the book is that specialization, I actually seeing that you do something very different than I do, is also grounds for collaboration. You know, so one thought is like, well, we're the same, so why don't we just merge and do the same thing together? We could do it stronger, better, because we're doing it together. But actually, there's this other way of looking at it, which is like, well, you actually do something very different than I do. So should we be in relationship? And if there's, let's say, 5 or 6 10, 15, 50 players, that the goal in those, especially in the cause sector, in the alliance world, in collective impact, is specialization. It's actually to reduce redundancy, to cover as much ground as you can, to map the assets of the whole community, not just what you can do, but what every single player in the field does. And to find, okay, well, we actually have four, I don't know, I'm just going to use a baseball metaphor. We have four people playing right field and we have nobody at shortstop. This is and eat. Mm. It's just an obvious thing. Once you just look at the field,
right?
Why do we have so many people in right field? I mean, if you have to do without somebody, do without a right fielder, especially if you have right-handed batters, right? So recognizing that stuff is only possible if we come to the table together. Hmm. If we put all our cards on the table and we all look at it, we sort of take a global view of the strengths and weaknesses of us as a whole, right? So that happens if people would just come together and see themselves as some sort of alliance or some community. Mm. That becomes possible. And then somebody who's a right fielder says, well, I played shortstop in high school. Maybe I could go and pick that up, because it's certainly better than having no one. I mean, literally, I could stand in that gap. I could stand in that part of the field. That's what baseball positions are. They're just gaps. They're covering ground, right? Mm. And this is true. It's certainly true in, social justice, care for the poor, certain cause areas. You just really need to cover all the ground as much as possible. And, you know, the church is a harder picture to grasp, to really see where are we all. I mean, there's geography, but then there's also areas of emphasis, strengths, weaknesses, and seeing that is much harder. It's much more confusing, but I think it still applies. I think that principle still applies. Where are we weak? Where are there gaps? Where are we kind of overloaded? And can, once we see that, can we ask some people who are in an overloaded area to shift into, an underserved area? And that could be some sort of work that's being done. It could be a geography part of the city. I mean, we've probably talked about this before. I mean, in my lifetime, I've probably seen 50, 60, 100, I don't know, churches planted in the Tampa Bay area. People that come here from somewhere else to plant. And, you know, the immature part of me is kind of like, who invited you? Did your city not need evangelism or something? But you know, people want to move to Florida and they want to plant a church, and probably they're right to do that, and probably they're called by God, and who am I to judge that? But they all plant churches in the same places, you know, like all of those churches. Like, I've never seen a single person move to Florida and plant a church in East Tampa. Mm-hmm. Never. I'm not saying it hasn't happened, but that would be news to me.
Yeah.
I've never seen that. I've never seen anyone plant a church in East Tampa who wasn't from East Tampa. So what's going on there? You know, maybe it's just a lack of imagination. They don't see the whole board, you know?
Yeah.
But then we just keep planting churches in the same places to the same, reaching the same people, you know?
Yeah.
So specialization and an inability to see the whole field is also something that keeps us from collaborating. Because I think if we could see it, we would say, okay, what can I do? Maybe I'm a church plant. So you're saying nobody goes over here? Well, then what if we go there? We'd be happy to cover that spot or that ground. Or no one cares about this community. Maybe it's a refugee community or something, or a certain language speaking community. Say, well, there's no churches to those people. Well, then maybe we need to reach them or take that mantle on ourselves, you know?
Yeah. Which, I don't know. I think that goes back to, it really becomes a question of, do you care about the kingdom more than you care about yourself? Because I'm listening to you talk and I'm thinking, that sounds great. And I love that, because when you see the whole field and you see the gaps, what emerges then are new callings, right? So even as you talk about the potential of merging and becoming something, or like relinquishing your group, it's like, actually, and maybe one of the things that sometimes can keep us is like, well, if we merge together, to a certain extent, it almost feels like, is this just, now this is going to sound really bad, but is this what innovation is? Like, you split apart to come back together, to split apart again, to come back together. So like, I even think about our phones, right? Like, or even apps. It's like at one point it was cool to have everything in one thing. And then it's like, actually, let's specialize. And now you have Apple Music and now you have your podcast and then whatever. But eventually, well, what if you could just have it all in one place? Well, so I just wonder sometimes, like with microchurches and or just in general, the idea of merging, like, is it to merge, to split apart because things, healthy things do multiply? Is that you come together for a season so that it multiplies? That's a whole other train of thought. But essentially, like, yeah, you see gaps, new callings emerge, people can dive into those things, which is exciting. But also at the same time, like, I think about the power dynamics at work in that room, because you're saying, okay, this thing that you've existed to do, I'm asking you, are you willing to jettison all of that, to completely remake your boat almost so that it serves this purpose? And that can't be done in a hierarchical top down, I'm the one who's in charge, because then it's all the things that make us suspicious about collaboration. It has to be something that emerges as the group is together looking at this need. And I don't know, you have to count the cost, and it really has to be about, like, do I value the kingdom more than I value this thing that's maybe been our identity as an organization or as a microchurch for so long, that we do this one thing, to say, like, no, you, yeah. What is it? You don't, I'm going to butcher this story, but it's like that story of the organization, that the company that's like, actually our mandate isn't to sell nails, but to, like, make holes. And so we can go with laser technology or whatever.
People don't buy a drill bit. They buy a hole. They want is a hole. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a reckoning here, like an indictment to your question. Do we really care about the kingdom? I think that we're going through probably the church in the West is going through a pruning, a purging almost in answer to that question, that maybe we don't care about the kingdom. Like, there are too many of us that actually, when push comes to shove, are not all that interested in the kingdom. Mm-hmm. But that higher goal and finding that higher goal together and agreeing on that is profoundly important. Yeah, I not long ago I read this story about when Ronald Reagan was trying to have that first summit with Mikhail Gorbachev to sort of usher in this era of perestroika, which of course ends in the coming down of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet Union, essentially. But that was an incredibly tough time. For those of us that lived through it, like the idea that the USSR and the USA would ever have any kind of relationship with each other or collaborate on anything or even have any common ground at all was very hard to imagine, right? So you're Ronald Reagan and you're trying to, you got to, like, have this meeting, this first meeting with Gorbachev. Like, what do you say and what do you bring up? So I think it was in Geneva, end of 1985. And Reagan sits down with Gorbachev and it's kind of like cameras and it's not kind of working. And then they go take a walk. And for years and years and years, nobody knew what they talked about on that walk. I think it was Charles Schulz's autobiography that came out not long ago, maybe 10, 20 years or something, where he knew what was talked about that. And apparently what Reagan asked Gorbachev, which I just think this is extraordinary. He asked him, he started with the question, if aliens were to attack us from outer space, would you help us? Like, would you, would we work together to defend planet Earth? You know, now I don't know if Reagan's just a screwball that believed in aliens or he's a genius or something. I don't know. It's up to the listener, I suppose, but what a question.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. You know, there's almost nothing that they agree on. But then he found something. But I mean aliens that we're trying to kill all humans. We are both human, right? This is our planet.
Yeah.
We're the two superpowers of the era. would we join forces to fight against little green men trying to take our planet from us? To which Gorbachev said, his words were, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a place to start. That's a place to start. Now, that's farcical almost, like there's no such thing as aliens. So sorry, listeners, but you know, there is such a thing as unbelief. There is such a thing as idolatry. There is such a thing as exploitation. You know, there is such a thing as sin and hell and death. And these great enemies belong to the human race too, you know, oppose the human race. And are we not meant to be the vanguard of the people of God, confronting, addressing, not, you know, the weapons that we fight with are not the weapons of this world, but nevertheless, you know, are we not in a confrontation with those evil forces? And in that sense, can't any Jesus follower, anybody that loves Jesus, can't we agree on that? Can't we find that common ground together? I think the answer is yes. You know, figuring out that actually there is that triangulated goal, commitment, hope that we share. Obviously, the more time we spend together, the more we might realize we disagree on loads of other things. I mean, Reagan and Gorbachev would have agreed on very little after that, right? But that's the starting point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That transcendent cause, that keeps us together, that superordinate goal, to go back to Shane Snow and Dream Teams. But I'd love for you to, I don't know, I mean, as we're talking about this and talking about the possibilities that are maybe latent in collaboration, like if you think about your own work as someone who has planted churches, walked with people planting churches and microchurches and seeing them maybe come together, like, yeah, what stories or examples maybe show or highlight the power of collaboration when it's present? Or maybe ways that you have seen microchurches use or benefit from collaboration.
I mean, at a grassroots level, I think we've seen lots of examples of, you know, people trying to reach a population, maybe with certain challenges, and realizing, okay, these people have addiction problems, they have, you know, the employment hurdles, they have mental health things, and realizing we can't even help one person with all of those things. So I think we've seen in the history of the underground here in Tampa, we've seen beautiful kind of organic collaborations emerge with people that are good, that work just in that mental health, or work just in, you know, job, employment, skills, placement, whatever. And then people over here that do discipleship, and then people over here that do healing, prayer, and people over here that provide housing. And suddenly you can step back, and something like the underground looks like this really formidable collaboration. And so what the collaboration is really built on is covenant as a network. So the network itself covenants with itself without realizing. It's almost like we trick people into collaboration by saying, well, we're all part of the underground. So then we're aware of each other. And then when people that are in my microchurch need what you do, I just send them your way. It's referrals, right? And so the collaboration is really not necessarily between microchurches or between agencies, but it's this kind of seamless travel between microchurches and what they do and what they provide. I think we've seen loads of that, right? And even something like the Underground Clinic, which exists essentially as a service to microchurches who lack, you know, professional medical skill. And so you can build a clinic which essentially serves them. That's almost like the sinews of the body, the network, which is itself a collaboration, the whole thing. Now, having said that, I think there's other really exciting examples in our time of collective impact and collaboration. You know, one would be something called Every Tribe, Every Nation, also Illuminations, which is a part of that project, which is about Bible translators. And, you know, Bible translation is a pretty clear goal.
Yeah.
We'd like to get the Bible, the New Testament translated in every kind of known language, every charted language, let's say. It's a really interesting group of people. They're sort of nerdy. Now they're into technology. They go, they sometimes give their whole entire lives to a people group, to a, you know, a small area of the world that speaks a certain language, to kind of faithfully translate the New Testament into that language. Really cool mission. And there's, I don't know how many, there's 8 or 10 agencies, bigger agencies that kind of work on that problem. And their projections, I think, I want to say, I'm just pulling this out of my head, but I want to say their projections were that they would have the Bible into every language by something like 2150 or something like that. That was their projected rate, at the rate in which we are kind of, you know, attaining, adding languages to the catalog. It'd be 2050, something like that. So a major giver came in and said, well, what if we fund you if you all work together on this project? So see it as one goal, work completely as a unit, essentially as an alliance, as a single entity trying to get to this goal. And so, you know, I have friends at work that have created the kind of backbone organization to help them work together. So their marketing teams all work together, their COOs all work together. Everybody at every level, they sort of, their tech people, their translators, all this stuff, they started sharing technology, sharing ideas, sharing the goal itself. And this incredible efficiency started to emerge. So their new projected timeline for every single language in the known kind of world translated is 2034. So you're something like that. So they've shaved 100 years off of that by working together. That's and again, wild. We're talking about 12-ish agencies. I don't know exactly, but and if that's even sort of true or close to true, or now it's costly to do that. It's expensive, yeah. And all those leaders have had to, they all fundraise together now. They don't fundraise apart. They say this, that we fundraise this goal. And they've entrusted themselves, instead of protecting their organizations, their agencies, in some cases like a Wycliffe or American Bible Trans, and these American Bible Society, these are old agencies with a lot to protect, right? With a way of doing things and belief system or whatever, they've said, this is more important. The translations are more important than us, than anything else. And the acceleration of that goal is so profound. I mean, 100 years, are you serious? Just by doing that, by taking that simple step. It's not simple, is it? But it's an obvious step and move. And interestingly enough, it took a philanthropist. It actually took a giver. It took the money side to say, I'd really like you guys to work together. You know, I've got whatever it is, you know, $100 million or $500 million and I will fund this to happen, but you have to work together. And that's interesting because, you know, I'm also working more these days in the philanthropic side of ministry, and interesting, like seeing the giver side, the philanthropist side wake up to their own significance and calling, and actually me pleading with high capacity donors and givers to kind of demand that agencies that they support collaborate with other agencies and actually stop funding agencies that won't, you know, that don't play well with others, that either think they're the answer so they don't need any partnerships, or they're just too cantankerous to work with other people or whatever, that's actually a reason to slow funding to those siloed agencies. So again, I'm thinking about individual causes, and something as clear as Bible translation is a great example. Because of that, you know, the kind of isolation of that single goal, you see what's possible.
Yeah, that's so cool. Oh my goodness. Yeah,
And maybe, you know.
By the way, for anyone listening out there that knows these stories, I just want to apologize for any erroneous error, any erroneous data that I've given. It's ballparks here. Ballpark true.
I don't know. I think, you know, there's definitely a way that we've seen, I mean, that is an example, maybe the underground as an example of collaboration. But I'm also curious if there's a way that we haven't yet imagined collaboration between microchurches or what have you, that it's like, oh man, we haven't seen this, but this would be really cool, or this is an option. Like, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that or...
Well, I think what we have yet to see really is microchurches in relationship with other microchurches that are not in their own network. So we're still sort of network tied relationally. Now we're flirting with other movements and so on. Like the underground has friendships all around the country and all around the world, and we've tried in our own way to be a part of that group, and it's convening. So like the microchurch conference is a good example, which I think will happen again next year. But I think that's also important is to see ourselves, for us to relate, microchurches to relate to other microchurches outside of their own network. Mm. So even microchurches that are in other churches. So traditional churches are starting to adopt microchurches or encourage microchurches or in some small way begin to support microchurches within their traditional congregational governance or form. You know, it'd be great if those microchurches could be in relationship with other microchurches that were not in their little network. And, you know, it's like we should look for each other. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, I don't know. Because I'm white, but spent a lot of my life in a black neighborhood, I know what it's like to walk into a store with all black people. And I also know what it's like to walk into a store where it's all white people and you see one black person. And what I notice is if there's one black person and another black person walks in, they make eye contact with each other and they make sure that they know, I see you, I'm mm-hmm. with you. It's just us. And that happens anywhere there's a minority. Mm. You know, a kind of reverse story of that would be the first few times I was in Haiti. You can go days in Haiti as a white person and you're the only white person you see. But then if you see a white person, I mean, it stands out. And so you make eye contact and you say, hey, I see you. I know you. Mm. It's that feeling of solidarity that we need when we're in a minority, when we're like, are we the only ones here? We may be the only ones here. So let's recognize each other. Let's acknowledge each other. Let's draw just a tiny little bit of strength from that, you know? And I think that's true. That could be and needs to be true for microchurches. Microchurches need each other. They need to recognize in this greater ecosystem of church development, medium-sized, large churches, all kinds of churches. Microchurches need to lock eyes with each other in their cities, and they need to recognize, I see you. I got you. You're not alone. And even within a denomination or something like that. I don't know much about denominations, but let's just say Baptist or something like that. Maybe the microchurches in Baptist churches, they really need to, lock eyes with each other and say, I see you. And let me introduce you to some other microchurch people and some other people that are trying something small. You know, because even if they're not repressed or held back or harmed in some way by the larger thing, they definitely can feel alone. So this is like level one of collaboration, mm-hmm. is to just recognize a connection or a bond and feel the support that comes from that. If nothing else happened in collaborative environments, that's worth doing. Mm-hmm. That in of itself, just saying, you know what, you're not alone. And I know that subject has come up many times in this conversation on this podcast, you know, that microchurches need to not feel alone. Mm-hmm. So then once we have relationship, once a bond is formed, something can happen. You know, those two people in a store can come up to each other and be like, you live around here? Let's talk. Let's let our families connect. Let's, you know, mm-hmm. more can happen, and maybe even business can be done, or or new projects can happen because of that relationship. But you don't just walk up to anybody in a store. You walk up to somebody that you think, I have some affinity, I have some connection to this person that I don't have with others. So I'm going to make sure that we don't feel alone. And then what comes out of that, I think, is the possibility of, you know, new enterprise.
Yeah.
New ideas, new ways of working together. And sometimes maybe at its core, what drives collaboration is friendship. Mm. You know, it's feeling like I like you.
Yeah.
And I'd like to do something with you. You know, I'd like for us not just to turn around now and go back to our lives, but to find a way. And maybe that starts with a kind of inefficiency, but it ends in something which I think Jesus is saying bears witness to the truth of his coming.
Very cool. Well, maybe I'll end it there. I mean, this has been a fun conversation. And for those of you listening and wondering what book that we're talking about, I will point you to Brian's 5 Keys of Cross-Organizational Collaboration. You can find that on Amazon. I believe when I was looking even earlier, there's an audio version of that too, like
there is,
which you narrate, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. So for all of you who are like, I don't have the time, first of all, it's not a huge book, and so you can find time to read it. But if you're like, I really just don't have time, there is an audiobook available too. And so go ahead, check that out. I highly recommend it. Super helpful, practical. And I, you know, I don't think these two things are opposed to each other necessarily, but I do think that they can be sometimes. It's not just practical, but I think it also gives you imagination and dream for what is possible. And so sometimes those can feel like opposing things, like you either have the visionary or the tactical. And I think this book does both very well. And so thank you, Brian, for being on this podcast. Thank you for all your work.
Thanks,
in being a student of collaboration. And so this has been Microchurches. Until next time.